The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
Listeners, welcome back to the EMS Educast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Greg Fries, this week in Wisconsin at home. Today was a big day for me. It was my son's final day of kindergarten. It was just a great moment to go and pick him up. It was a bunch of parents. I would say I was reduced to a combination of pride and on that verge of weeping watching my son make this transition from kindergarten to summer and then to first grade. It's hard to believe. And he just had a great first year of school, and his mom, my wife, and I, we couldn't be more proud of him. So it was a great last day of kindergarten, and we're looking forward to kicking off summer tomorrow. And it's just going to be an exciting summer. And speaking of summer, I should mention that we do have shows scheduled, a couple more shows in June, and then we're going to take about a 4 or 5 week break through the end of June and most of July of the podcast. So Rob and Bill and I can enjoy the long summer days with our friends and family. And then towards the end of July, early August, we'll kick up again with new episodes. But continue to interact with us and other listeners at facebook.com/EMSEducast or twitter.com/EMSEducast. You can find us there. And Rob, I'm sure you're already in summer there, right? Your school's been out and it's summertime.
We're in full summer with 32 degrees Celsius today. I think that's about 90 degrees Fahrenheit and 60% humidity. So nice warm day out there. And the students are done.
Yeah.
And I'm still at the college until mid-June. And we have our convocation next week. So I'm really excited about seeing my grads and meeting their families for the first time. So.
And are you already picking up your summer ambulance work, or do you have a couple weeks away from that still?
A couple of weeks away. I'm still working weekends, but I'll be working 24 hours to 36 hours a week over the summer.
Wow.
Except in July. I'll be in Disney. I'll be at Disney World in July.
Nice. A month?
No, but 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, middle of July, so.
Very nice.
Yeah, we'll be driving there, driving back, hoping to avoid tornadoes or mishaps on the road.
Keep your eye on the weather. Maybe you should look into one of those paramedic positions at Disney World.
Yeah.
Pack up
you know what? My wife's afraid to go on dates with me because someone collapses or has a seizure in front of me. So it changes when we're at Disney World. It's the same sort of thing.
Really?
Kind of rolls her eyes as I go over to help.
I went out for a bike ride on, I believe it was Sunday morning. Yeah, Sunday morning. And a couple miles into our bike ride, and we came across a biker versus biker bicycles. Sometimes I say bike ride and people imagine me on a Harley Davidson, but more imagine me skiers and spandex. And we came up on biker versus biker accident and collision on a biking path and possible broken wrist is what I called it. But she just wanted to get picked up and go home with her husband and maybe go to urgent care later. But a little first aid there in the field, which mostly was completed with the use of a cell phone. So, Rob, we've got a guest. I should just mention that Bill might be joining us. He's doing some traveling and may or may not be able to find a phone or an internet connection to join us. So, listeners, if you're missing Bill, maybe he'll jump in later. But now I want to turn to our guest. We're really pleased to be joined by Lisa Braithwaite. And Lisa's joining us from California, and she can tell us more about what she does as a public speaking coach. But Lisa and I first connected over Twitter, and Because I have an interest in public speaking and presenting, a reader of her blog, and we correspond through blog post comments and Twitter posts about some of our shared interests in presenting. And then a while ago, a listener asked about a show with public speaking focus and tips and tricks and ideas to become better at public speaking. So I immediately thought of Lisa, and just really glad to have you join us, Lisa. So welcome to the EMS Educast.
Thank you, Greg and Rob. It's great to be here.
Well, we certainly are glad to have you. Maybe you could start off with just introducing yourself to the audience, maybe where you're at now geographically and about the kind of work you do as a public speaking coach.
Geographically, I'm in Santa Barbara, California, and we are experiencing the first of our annual June gloom. Most people think Santa Barbara is paradise and really sunny and beautiful all year round. And while it is paradise, we do have this secret, and that is summer is entirely foggy. So
really?
I just want to let you know that. If you ever want to come visit Santa Barbara, the best time to come is September.
Okay.
Just
I'm
so
feeling
you know.
Like I got to find where Santa Barbara is and on map.
Well, Santa Barbara is about an hour and a half north of Los Angeles.
Okay.
So we are technically still in Southern California, but we're also called the Central Coast of California.
Nice. Okay.
So, and any TV show you ever see that's supposedly filmed in Santa Barbara, like Psych, is not. And Santa Barbara looks nothing like what they have on that show.
Okay.
So there's my little spiel about Santa Barbara, if anybody's interested.
Where would it typically be filmed then? What city would they typically use?
Gosh, I don't know. All I can tell you is that it's not Santa Barbara. It looks nothing like Santa Barbara, as a matter of fact.
I know a lot of movies that take place in New York are actually filmed in Toronto, Canada. So that's we always play that game.
Yeah.
Identify that building or that street corner.
It looks kind of like it looks kind of like Orange County to me. But the movie that was filmed here was recently was the movie with Meryl Streep and Alec Baldwin. I'm blanking on the name.
The ABBA movie.
It's complicated.
Okay.
And that was filmed here, and they actually showed very lovely views of Santa Barbara.
Nice. So tell us about
Yes, I'm in love with Santa Barbara because I was born here. So beyond that.
Right. Tell us about the work
you do.
Want
me to talk a little bit about. So I do individual public speaking coaching, working with individuals to help them build their skills and confidence as speakers. And then I also expand that out into group coaching, where I do small groups of six people for 6 weeks at a time, and we work on public speaking issues, and we do practice presentations and videotaping and so forth. And I also do corporate training and corporate coaching, and I also teach people how to do more effective PowerPoint, as well as creating PowerPoints for my clients who need them. And that's kind of the coaching and training aspect of what I do. And then, as Greg mentioned, I write a public speaking blog called Speak Schmeek, and I've been doing that for about 6 years now. And my life revolves around public speaking.
I have to ask you, Lisa, did you watch The King's Speech, the movie?
I watched it, and then I immediately went and watched it again.
Really?
I think I watched it the very day it came out.
It was that good? Or was
loved it. You haven't seen it?
I have not seen it. I will see it soon.
It's really great. I mean, besides the fact that it's a historical historical story, and then it itself is really interesting to kind of see behind the scenes of this family, this royal family. It's fascinating to watch what this person went through to go from being an extremely uncomfortable, nervous stammerer to an accomplished speaker. Mm-hmm. And from what I've read, it's very true to what really happened. They found they used Lionel Logue's Lionel Logue is speech coach in the movie. They used some of his journals. The person who originally wrote this book that the movie was made from, I should say, they used his journals to help show them the kinds of training and vocal training and various exercises and activities that they did to help him with the, both the physical aspect of his speech impediment and also the mental aspects of kind of the mental blocks that he had and the fear that he had around speaking. Really, really fascinating and really, really well acted by everybody in the movie. I highly, highly recommend it, and not just as a speech coach, but just as somebody who loves a good movie.
Now, have you ever had to look after a client with those kinds of challenges?
I've never worked with anybody who stutters. I've worked with somebody who tells me that she stutters when she gets nervous, but I've never actually seen it happen. So I haven't actually worked with somebody who stutters, but this one client that I mentioned, with her, I just kind of tried to get behind what caused that or what would bring that up. At what point in her speech would she feel like she was going to start stuttering? And it usually had something to do with being afraid of losing her place, or not being able to find the right word. And so we worked kind of around that and worked on how she could incorporate more breathing, and more pausing, how she could go slower and really listen to her thoughts as they arose. There's a lot of people, when they're nervous, their mouth actually gets a little bit ahead of their brain and they don't even really hear what they're saying. They'll walk away from a presentation and they'll say, "I have no idea what I just said." And that was kind of happening to her. So we worked on just getting her to slow down and pause and breathe and really let her brain catch up with her mouth. And that helped her a lot. But I'm not a speech therapist, so you know, I don't specifically work on things like that, but that helped her.
I do want to just back up, though, a bit in the conversation and just how'd you get to where you are now? What were some of the steps along the way that positioned you to now be, you know, doing the coaching and the training work that you're doing now?
Pretty much everything that got me to where I am now was serendipitous. But it started from the time I was little, because I always liked to perform. I always would do little plays in front of my parents. You know, they'd have guests over and I'd grab all the kids and we'd create some sort of a play or some kind of musical number. And so I always liked performing. I always liked kind of being on stage. And I'm one of those rare people who likes the attention of being on stage. And I got into theater when I was in junior high, and I got onto the speech team when I was in high school, and then I was a theater major in college. And so that was still mostly a performance kind of a background, but I realized that I didn't want to be an actor professionally, first of all, because I kind of sucked at it. And secondly, I just didn't really like the competitive aspect of it and auditioning and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of got out of the mindset of wanting to be an actor and instead turned my interest to education, because I had always thought even if I were an actor, I would want to do something with kids or teach kids acting or something like that. And so then I went to grad school and I got a master's in education. And during that time, I was working in nonprofits here in Santa Barbara, and we have a huge nonprofit community here. And I just sort of fell into training and community outreach and, you know, facilitating groups and all this kind of thing. And while I was working in a domestic violence agency, I got roped into going into high school classrooms and talking about domestic violence, which petrified me, because in those days I was still afraid to talk in front of kids and teenagers. And that's really where I got my trial by fire, and that's really where I started to learn how to be a good speaker and how to get people's attention and how to engage an audience, how to build trust, how to be authentic, how to deal with hecklers, you know, right. All of those things kind of really came together in that job. And so after about 16 years of working in nonprofits, I kind of got burnt out on nonprofits. I kept getting laid off by one after another organization that would run out of money and run out of grant funding. And I decided that I wanted to go into business for myself. But at the time, I still wasn't thinking about public speaking at all. And I started another business. And while I was in a self-employment training program, somebody who had heard me speak for another nonprofit hired me to help her speak.
Okay.
It was completely a fluke. She just said, "You just look so comfortable on stage and you just look so natural and this and that. And I want to be like that." And I just, this light bulb went off in my head and I thought, man, you know, this is what I would love to do. It pulls together all of my love of teaching and training and performing and my degree in theater, my degree in education, and my long years of experience actually doing this in front of all kinds of live audiences. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks that this is what I should do. I should teach people how to do this. And that's it. I just jumped right in with both feet. And 6 years later, here I am.
What leads somebody, at what point does somebody recognize that they need a coach? Or is it usually like a series of failures, or the nerves get to them, or they recognize they have some growing talent and they come to you to help, I guess, draw out their natural talent as a speaker?
I would say it's all of the above.
Okay.
I think the majority of my clients already have some experience, and a lot of them even feel fairly comfortable with speaking, but they know that they could be doing a lot better. Sometimes it's because they've gotten feedback from their boss or their supervisor. Sometimes they've gotten audience evaluations that actually say kind of negative things. But a lot of my clients already have some experience speaking and feel fairly comfortable in front of an audience. And so a lot of what we're doing is helping them refine their skills and just make them a stronger speaker. But I do have plenty of clients who come to me with a great fear of speaking and an avoidance of speaking. So they don't even have any experience to speak of. They don't have any experience to even know if they would be a good speaker or not, because they've avoided it, consciously avoided it.
So Lisa, what would be
kind of the two biggest groups?
Is there a typical profile to the people who come to you? Are they people in sales, people in marketing, people who are CEOs or corporate climbers, or the educators, or are they right across the range?
They do vary, but I find that I attract people who are like me, who are self-employed entrepreneurs, who a lot of times are trainers and coaches and consultants, and therapists and ministers and that kind of thing. So a lot of self-employed professionals. And then for the people who aren't self-employed, who are working for somebody else, they do tend to be upper-level managers and directors, people who are in a leadership position, and maybe they do everything great in their job except expressing themselves. And I get the occasional book author who's petrified of speaking but has a book coming out and knows they're going to need to go out and promote the book and speak to the media and things like that. And even those book authors tend to be people who are entrepreneurs and kind of the fitness trainers and therapists and coaches and the kind of people that I'm talking about. Those are the people who tend to gravitate. But a lot of people who are just in kind of a training area, a lot of people, they find that their jobs are changing and they're having to do a lot more speaking than they ever did before. And this is across the board in our country anyway. It's becoming a really important skill to have for employers, that your new hires have good communication skills. And so people are finding, even when they've been in the same job for a while, that their boss is expecting them now to do some training and lead some meetings. And they're afraid of getting left behind if they don't upgrade their skills. So that's kind of another subset of my clients.
And what would be the typical process? Would they, obviously they contact you first, then you have an additional meeting, and presumably you give them some discussion, give them some pointers, try to identify what their fears are, what their concerns are, what they feel their weaknesses are. But at some point, do you watch them speak and give them feedback, or what would be the typical process with a client?
I don't always watch my clients speak. And sometimes that's not even, well, a lot of the time, that's not really necessary, because the work that we're doing together is leading them to a place where they can get up and speak. But the things, it depends. Again, you know, every client is really different, and we do a lot of different kinds of things. But kind of a typical client would be somebody who has a presentation that they have to give. And either it's a presentation that already exists, or a training of some sort, or a speech in some form, a wedding speech or something. And so either they come to me with something already existing that they need to work on and make better, or they come to me and they need to create something from scratch. But either way, however they come to me, whatever their material is, we always work on a couple of basic things. We always work on the structure and the flow, and that is, what are your main points? You know, how does everything flow together? Before we even get to that, I should have said we work on their objective. You know, what's their objective? What's their purpose? Mm-hmm. Who is their audience? What does their audience want and need and care about? And then we go from there. We work on a structure. We work on audience engagement. So how can they interact with the audience more? How can they ask questions? How can they get the audience involved so it's not just a one-way lecture? And then we talk about things like openings and closings, because having a strong opening is really important and a lot of speakers overlook it. And having a strong closing is even more important and the majority of speakers overlook it. Mm-hmm. So these are kind of a lot of the basic things in terms of content and putting a presentation together that I work with just about every single client. And then there's also the mental, kind of like I was talking about with the King's Speech, there's a lot of mental reframing that people have to do to maybe stop seeing public speaking in a negative light. Like I had a client say to me the other day, what do you think is worse, to bomb in front of 500 people or to bomb on The Tonight Show?
Yeah.
And I said, okay, so first of all, let's talk about this thinking that's going through your mind about bombing. You know, how about we stop thinking about bombing, and every time you think to yourself, I'm going to bomb, you turn it around and start thinking, I have so many great things to say. I have a lot to share with my audience. I have a lot of valuable information. You know, so a lot of the work I do, besides the structure and the content and all of that, is a lot of mental reframing and getting them to rethink the way they see speaking, rethink the way they understand their own skills and abilities, and try to get them on track with kind of a positive attitude.
Right. I've been thinking, I kind of made a list here of some things that our audience likely has to deal with as educators, and a lot of these are probably fairly common. And the first thing on my list is, I feel like as a speaker, whether it's at a conference or even in the classroom, I have an increasingly distracted audience because they have smartphones mm-hmm. and iPads and such. And that's mm-hmm. certainly not unique to the paramedic classroom.
Right.
What kind of tips or suggestions do you have for speakers? Because for me, it's two things. One is, like, I don't want to be distracted because the audience is distracted, but I also want to be offering up something that makes me worthy of them looking up from their device. So what kind of tips or ideas or thoughts do you have about that?
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts about that. First of all, I'm one of those people who actually takes notes on my phone. And so when I'm sitting in the audience and I'm typing on my phone, it's frequently because I'm taking notes that I'm going to use later to write a blog post.
That's a very good point.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry. I'm just saying that's a good point that a lot of speakers probably don't consider.
Right, exactly. And so for myself as a speaker, when I see people on their phones, I don't necessarily assume that they're not paying attention. So, and there are a couple reasons. The first one is when I mentioned, they could be taking notes. They could be tweeting fabulous things about me to all of their Twitter followers, which I like to fantasize is happening. They could just be people who need to fidget and move around while they're listening. You know, not everybody is the kind of person that can sit still in a seat and watch somebody speak for an hour. Some people need to be doing things with their hands and kind of multitasking in order for them to actually be paying attention. So I kind of look at, when I see people in the audience that are on their phones, I don't really take it personally. Now, that's to say, you know, in an audience of 50 people, there are a couple people scattered around the room that are doing something on their phone. If a significant number of people in the audience are doing that, then I probably would look at myself and think to myself, okay, I think I'm losing them, and I would switch things up a little bit. And sometimes it's as simple as just listening to your own voice and saying to yourself, am I starting to sound like I'm talking in a monotone? Do I need to just up my volume, or do I need to get a little color in my voice? Do I need to, you know, bring a little energy and excitement? You know, is it just something physical with me that's dragging them down? And sometimes it's the content, and then you can kind of say, you can even ask the audience, is everybody, you know, does it seem like we should move on from this point? Does everybody feel like you've really gotten it already? Or, you know, you can check in with the audience and see how they're doing. They may just have gotten your point 5 minutes ago, mm-hmm. and you're kind of, you know, beating a dead horse. So there are a lot of reasons why people would be on their phones, but I guess the bottom line is that I don't take it personally. I don't assume that everything is about me. Because the truth is, your audience is only ever giving you, 70% of their attention. And even before smartphones, that's the way it was. You know, you're thinking about what's for dinner, and you're thinking about the stack of work on your desk, and you're thinking about, I hope I pick up my son from his last day of kindergarten on time. You know, these are the things that are going through people's minds. They're really not like 100% focused on you usually.
I think the flip side of that.
Yeah.
So I think the flip side mm-hmm. of that too is I find it really off-putting when a speaker gets up and before they talk, and it's not so much just what they say, it's the tone of voice too, when they say to the audience, please turn off your cell phone.
Yeah.
We don't want any interruptions.
Mm.
You know, I find that a little offensive because, you're not being treated like adults. And like you said, you know, people could be using their cell phone to be tweeting great things about the speaker or saying to their colleagues who are at another concurrent session, you got to come over here. This guy is going to be great.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I don't take it personally. I don't even assume it's about me. But if it is about me, I assume that it's going to be good things about me.
Right.
And I really don't let it bother me. And I think you make a great point that you need to treat your audience like adults. And they can decide for themselves, you know, if they're going to listen to you or not. And you know, it's your job as a speaker to keep their attention. It's your job. Mm-hmm. So if you're not doing a good job and they are fading away for whatever reason, you need to get them back.
Yeah.
It's always your responsibility.
And I think it's reasonable to ask the audience to turn their smartphones to vibrate.
Oh, yeah,
and
for
just,
sure.
And just leave it at that, you know. Or, you know, even put up a slide with no sound, that sort of a comical thing that says, you know, let's vibrate, not ring or something.
There you go.
I like that. You know, and to be honest, I've never asked the audience to turn off their phones.
Me neither.
And frequently somebody's phone rings in the middle of my presentation and we just kind of laugh it off. I keep talking. They get, mm-hmm. they're embarrassed. They get their phones. They run out of the room. I mean, you
exactly.
know, it's not the end of the world, and I'm not going to make a big deal out of it. I mean, my phone's rung in the middle of things before too, and I was the embarrassed one running out of the room.
Right.
We're all human, you know. We all make mistakes, so I don't worry about it.
I've another thing on my mind is that so in the course of caring for a patient that a paramedic, and really at the student level when you're a paramedic student, you have two chances to make a report about your patient. The first is as you're driving down the road, you can call a report to the hospital about the patient that you're bringing to the hospital. And then when you arrive at the hospital, you're handing off the patient to a nurse or a physician, and you give a patient handoff report. And mm-hmm. I've seen some students that have really struggled with those two. They're really public speaking opportunities. The first one seems to be just the sort of the uncertainty of talking into the abyss of not being able to make a personal connection because you're just on a radio or a phone. And then the second one, the handoff report, is that there's a hierarchical or a power relationship that you're a paramedic student and you might be giving a report to a physician. You know little, they know a lot type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so our audience being the educators, what kind of tips and ideas would you have for the instructors to help prepare their students to give those reports? And certainly we can add more depth about the task as you might need it.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of issues here. I'm going to actually write down a couple of things before I forget. So we're talking about the conciseness. First of all, the conciseness of the report to the doctor, and the doctor who knows a lot, and the student who doesn't. That's one thing. And then the radio right. call, right?
Right.
Report. Okay. So, you know, the first thing that comes to mind really is that, and this again is typical of a lot of speakers, they don't know how to determine what's the most critical information. And so instead of giving the most critical information, they go into too much detail and tell too much information that doesn't need to be shared. Is that something that would be a concern when they're speaking to a doctor?
I think you've hit the nail on the head beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's exactly mm-hmm. it. I think it's conciseness, the right information, not too much information, and sounding like you know what you're talking about, using the right terminology.
Right.
And I was right. actually thinking
and
about
so,
one of the,
oh, yeah.
I was just going to say, I was thinking about one of the things you said earlier too about having a, how you want to start and how you want to finish. And then you can sort of be feeling out the listener to how much you add in between based on their
yeah.
body language and questions.
That's a great example of when an opening is really important because that's where, in this case, you don't have a lot. I mean, you don't have time for, niceties or the kinds of things that I do as an opening in a presentation would be very different. I would ask the audience a bunch of questions and I might take a little time. In this instance, it seems like you want to be more kind of summarizing, that your opening would be a summary.
Right.
And then depending on what more information you're asked for, you fill it in, right?
Right.
Also the issue of reporting to a doctor who knows a lot and you're the student and you don't know a lot. And this is another thing I hear from a lot of speakers who say, I'm speaking at this conference and the people in the room are not only my peers, but they're my superiors. And the people in the room are experts, and I'm a grad student, and these people are scientists or whatever. And I hear this a lot. And I'm really intimidated, and I'm afraid they're going to ask me questions that I don't know the answer to. And so there's a lot of fear in and intimidation or perceived intimidation in those kinds of situations. And I always, this is another example of reframing, but that the truth is you always have something to say. You have a way of saying things or a way of expressing things that other people don't. You're different. You're a different person. And everybody can learn something from you. And, you know, trying to help people understand that the rest of the people in the room, like that doctor in the emergency room, he's not sitting there looking like waiting for you to make a bunch of mistakes, right?
Right.
He's not standing there going, oh man, this student, I know they're going to blow it. I can't wait till they blow it because I'm going to laugh.
Well, there might be some.
That's not what your audience is thinking. Well, I actually have heard that doctors are the worst audience. I have several corporate clients.
Well,
several corporate clients who are like medical consultants or healthcare consultants, and they speak to audiences of doctors, and they say that's exactly what the doctor wants to do, is to challenge you and make you look stupid. But honestly, I don't think that's happening in the emergency room.
Well, medicine's interesting because they challenge each other, and I think that's, I don't know if that's unique between, you know, compared to other disciplines or other professions, but physicians at conferences definitely challenge one another. So it's a new experience mm-hmm. when you're entering the emergency medical services field. What I was going to say was that, you know, sort of on the line of cellular phones and distractions, nurses and physicians are probably the most distracted listeners of all, because when a student's given a report, they're kind of focused on the patient. Sometimes they want to get in there and do a little patient assessment, and they look like they're not listening at all. So that's where you kind of have to keep talking and not worry about the fact that they're not making eye contact with you. So that
right. That's exactly it. It's kind of like what we were talking about before, where you can't assume that your audience is not with you. I mean, there's all this stuff we've heard about body language, and if somebody has their arms crossed, that means they're resistant to you, and all these kinds of things. And everybody has a different way of listening, and everybody has a different way of paying attention. And I've had audience members before who have their arms crossed and they're stone-faced and they don't look like they're interested at all in what I'm saying. And then they come up to me later and tell me how much they got out of my presentation. And so it's another thing is making assumptions. You know, audience speakers make assumptions about their audience members. And I'm guessing that an EMS student would do the same thing, make assumptions about the doctor, like they're not paying attention, or I'm doing it wrong, or I must not be saying the right thing, or mm-hmm. whatever.
I think
this mental reframing comes into it. And it's about, look, if the doctor's not complaining, right, or the doctor's not saying, wait, that wasn't clear, I didn't understand what you said, or, I mean, I think if the doctor needed clarification, the doctor would ask.
That's good advice, because I suspect the number of assumptions is probably inversely proportional to the level of the speaker's level of security. So the more insecure they are, mm-hmm. the more assumptions they make.
Right.
Exactly.
It's a weird way of stating it.
Yeah.
But
no, I completely agree with that. Completely agree.
Yeah. I'm enjoying this sort of hypotheticals. Are you ready for another one?
Okay.
Yeah. I was thinking about your background in nonprofit work, and our colleagues in education face similar challenges in that from time to time they need to ask for money. Whether, you know, one thing that's coming up a lot in paramedic education is wanting to build these human patient simulators and these simulation labs that require really expensive equipment. And so educator probably, in addition to writing some sort of grant proposals, are probably finding themselves in front of committees of decision makers to mm-hmm. to pitch their idea and make a case for their grant proposal. And that's another public speaking scenario. And the tough part, I think, is probably getting to the point where you actually ask for the money. I've done some nonprofit mm-hmm. fundraising, and That's a, you always have to get to the point where you say, and we need you to write this big check. Can you do that? And so what, does that come up in the work that you've done, or what suggestions would you have for an educator that's having to make a pitch?
It does. And, you know, having been in nonprofits a long time myself, I actually wasn't usually on the end of asking for money until I had my own nonprofit. And then I found myself having to go to the funders myself and having to sit down with an individual donor myself and ask for a $5,000 check. And I'm not going to say that I liked it. And that's actually one of the reasons I got out of nonprofits, because I hated asking for money. But one, and again, you know, it's a way of rethinking it. You're not asking, it's not asking a favor. You know, a lot of people feel like I'm asking for them to do me a favor. I'm asking for them to do something for me. It's like I have my hand out. And so people feel uncomfortable because, you know, because they feel like they're begging. Right. And one of the best things that I learned about asking for money was that you always present it as an opportunity for the other party. Mm. It's an opportunity for the funder to do something really valuable in the community. It's an opportunity for the funder to save more lives, or whatever it is, the equipment that you need or the technology that you need, whatever need that's going to serve. That's what the funder's doing. They're not giving you a handout.
Right.
It's not like they're doing you a favor. Yeah, it's an opportunity for them to do something really big and important.
That's a great point. Excellent point. Or,
mm-hmm. and
or make the focus mm-hmm. on the benefit to the students. Because I think you're absolutely right. I think, because I know I've done that before when I've tried to sell something to my dean. I've gone in there with you know, the perception in my own mind was I was asking this for this money for me. Ultimately, it was for my students. But in my mind, I think I was thinking it's for me. And you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is typical in public speaking, too, is that speakers always think they're talking about themselves. And the more you talk about yourselves and the more you make the presentation about yourself, the less you're going to connect with your audience. But when you make your presentation about the audience and, again, about what they need and want and care about, then they connect with you. Then they understand, you know, because you're talking to them about things that are important to them. So you always, and this is a, you know, this is traditional sales technique, really. Is that, you know, you're always focusing on the benefits, not the features, not like this machine is so great, it's going to do this, 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 and this. I mean, yeah, that's part of the discussion, but what's the benefit to the funder of supporting that? Mm-hmm. You know, whoever your audience is, what's the benefit to them of doing what you want them to do? And when you start to put it in those terms, this is how you benefit. This is what you get out of it. That's all anybody ever cares about. What do I get out of this? Mm-hmm. Right?
So Lisa, when you hear someone speak, what are the things that make you cringe, that make you think, oh, why did she say that or do that? What are some of your, maybe pet peeves isn't the way to frame it, but what are the things that make you go, oh, if only I could have helped her, him?
Well, it's funny because I'm actually giving a presentation tomorrow, a short little presentation for a networking group that I'm part of, and I decided to make the presentation about rookie mistakes and things that really peg a speaker as somebody who just doesn't know what they're doing. And a few of the rookie mistakes are also things that are kind of pet peeves for me. One of them is one of the things that drives me crazy more than anything. When a speaker actually stands up in front of an audience and says, I'm really sorry, I didn't have enough time to prepare.
Oh, that's one of my pet peeves.
That makes me think, well, then why should I sit here and listen to you? I mean, I'm giving you
exactly.
an hour of my time and I'm giving you $60 of my money or whatever, and you couldn't bother to take the time to prepare, you know?
The worst I've ever seen, I attended the conference uh-huh. many years ago, and these two fellows were co-presenting, and one of them was actually writing text on a transparency as they were talking. And they apologized at the beginning, saying, we just put this together on the drive up here, and we're still working on it. that was my sentiment exactly. I can't sit through this.
No. That's the worst, yeah. You should never reveal to the audience how little you care about them, basically.
Yeah. Right.
So that's one of my pet peeves right there. Another thing is when people don't, I'm sorry?
Tell us more. Give us more.
Right.
Another thing is when the speaker doesn't check their equipment mm-hmm. in advance. And I have been a witness to this so many times where the speaker is at the front of the room pushing a button and they don't know why their PowerPoint isn't working. And it's because they haven't put it into presentation mode. Or
right.
This is part of my presentation for tomorrow, but I watched a speaker one time whose computer went to sleep every 60 seconds. And
that's
she
awesome.
Didn't know how to take it out, how to change that, you know. And then the one thing that was really funny about that speaker, instead of pointing at things on the screen that she wanted us to see, she pointed to her own computer monitor, which we couldn't see. It was turned the other way, you know. She pointed to things on the monitor so we could see them.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So, you know, not checking your technology, not knowing how your PowerPoint remote works, not knowing how your PowerPoint works, not knowing how your microphone works, not checking the room in advance to find out if the room is too cold or too hot or too noisy or set up in an uncomfortable configuration.
What's the flip side where, like, really early in a presentation you think to yourself, this speaker just did something, you know, what are some things that impress you right off the start that make you think this is going to be a good presentation because the speaker just did this sort of high-level technique or thing that reassured you that you were in for a good presentation?
Yeah, that's a really good way to look at it. That's definitely a different way to look at it. And I would say that for me, right off the bat, there are two things. One is when things are going well, okay? So when things are going well and there are no glitches and there are no problems and the speaker starts out with a very strong, engaging opening, something that's like a funny story or they get the audience involved in some way that lets me know that the speaker is interested in my participation, I love that. That's something that really like gets me right off the bat. But there's another thing that also really impresses me, and that's when things are going wrong, when the technology isn't working, or somebody's late, or something is going wrong in the room, and the speaker is as cool as a cucumber, and isn't frantically apologizing and sweating, and, oh my God, I'm so sorry, and I don't know why this is happening, or, you know, the kinds of things people do when they freak out. When a speaker can handle just whatever comes and let it kind of roll off their back with some humor and just get on with the show, that really impresses me.
Well, I love that question, Greg, because we're focusing on the positive, but as soon as you mentioned starting with something humorous, I immediately thought of the people who put up a comic strip and either say nothing about it or it's completely out of context with their presentation.
Yeah.
So I'm going back to the flip side again.
Puzzling
I'm
over.
Thinking, yeah, I'm thinking well-used humor. I do have another pet peeve that I want to mention because
yeah.
I think this is something that you, that your educators may come up against. Well, they may be doing it themselves in their presentations. But something that really drives me crazy is jargon. Jargon,
yeah.
Acronyms, any kind of lingo, industry lingo that the person doesn't explain and just assumes that everybody in the room knows what they're talking about. And generally, it's a good idea to make sure your audience knows what you're talking about. And that doesn't mean, do you all know what this means? Do you all know what this means? And then people nod their heads awkwardly because they're embarrassed.
Right.
They don't want to say no. I don't know what it means, you know.
Right.
But to actually use, if you're using this kind of word or this kind of language that you say, and for those of you who aren't familiar with this language, this means XYZ, or for those of you who don't know this acronym, it stands for blah, blah, blah. And because audiences, you know, adults have such big egos. We just don't want to look foolish. We don't want to raise our hand and say, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what that means. You know, we feel embarrassed. And so people aren't going to do it. And instead, they're just going to sit in their seat feeling stupid, feeling resentful, getting completely lost and distracted. And then that's when they get on their phone and start playing, you know, bedazzled or whatever.
They're just Googling the acronym.
Yeah.
and of
now,
course,
that's one benefit of a smartphone. You can look stuff up.
Right.
But you can also be tweeting and saying, man, this guy's a real jerk. You know? That's the other side of it, right?
Yeah, right. Well, we are nearing the end of our hour together, so I want to start wrapping this up. And one of the things I was thinking about is that I'm sure you do coaching with clients probably that are all over the world potentially, or is it best if somebody tries to find if they were looking for a speaking coach to find somebody locally, and then how would you go about doing that? You know, what should somebody look for? How do they find a coach? And then how do they decide if a coach is the good fit for them? Is my final question.
First of all, I do work with people on the phone, and a lot of coaches do, and it's entirely possible to do that and even see your client giving a presentation by uploading a video to YouTube or something like that. So I do that with a lot of my clients. I do have some people who want to work with somebody in person, and maybe I'm not in their area, and I'm connected with a lot of other coaches and trainers, and so I'll try to find somebody who might be near them or somebody who could refer me to somebody that I can then refer to that person. Oh gosh, I think I'm going to forget.
Oh, I was just going to, like, what should I look for in a coach? Like, what would,
Right. Well, you know, ideally, you just have to feel like the coach is on your side. I think that's a really big part of it. And that your coach should kind of match your style of learning. And that's not to say that you should look for a coach who's going to make things easy, because I just had a client today who mentioned to me how he's been doing this opening for his presentation and he feels pretty comfortable with it. And I told him, I don't want you to feel comfortable with it, because when you feel comfortable, it's because you're doing the same thing you've been doing. And this opening is not good and you need to change it. You know, I need my clients to feel a little bit uncomfortable. Otherwise, why are they hiring me if they just want to keep doing the same thing they've been doing? So you do need somebody who's going to challenge you, but somebody who fits your style. You know, if you're good with somebody who's kind of in your face and kind of, you know, pushes you hard, then you want to, you know, ask them questions and get to know them in that consultation session. If you want somebody who's more gentle and more like a therapist, you know, that's what consultations are for. And I do a 30 to 45 minute free consultation so that people can ask me questions, I can ask them questions, and we can determine if we're a good fit, because I'm also looking at this client to see if they're coachable. I mean, in right. our consultation, I want to know if this person is ready. Are they ready? Are they willing to do the homework? Are they willing to take the risks of stepping out of their comfort zone? So both of us, you know, we're both wanting to know, is this going to be a good fit? I think most coaches do a free consultation, but I'm not sure.
I was going to say, when they're looking for a coach, they should also look for someone with the first name Lisa and the last name Braithwaite.
Right.
So.
That is correct. That is correct. I'll tell you what, if you Google public speaking coach, I'm usually number one on Google for public speaking.
Wow. That's
so it's kind of easy to find me.
You know what, Lisa?
Well, you can test it.
We use Skype to record the show. I was thinking Skype would be a great place to get feedback from a speaking coach, because you can video Skype, you can, you know, audio Skype. Be great. Probably even better than a
phone. It's true. I have used Skype with clients before.
Mm-hmm. Rob, do you have a final thought or question?
Well, Greg, wow, this time has really flown by quickly. I was going to ask, you know, I think you got to have a great voice too. And people don't know this, but Greg actually sounds like me normally, but an hour before the show, he screams at the top of his lungs. And that's how he has that great, you know, raspy voice that he has.
I did help coach T-ball in the dust this afternoon, so that could have something to do with it.
But yeah, we didn't get. I was going to ask you, Greg. What? How do you think you became comfortable speaking? Was it just through continuous practice, or?
Yeah, you know, I'm not. I was actually thinking about this the other day because I have a very vivid memory of eighth grade English class and having to give speeches and being just a real nervous wreck, and then I just found myself having more and more opportunities to do presentations. And then in college, I was in the marching band at the University of Wisconsin. And I really recognized I was not a very good musician, but I could be a very good performer. And I just got really comfortable performing and being in front of an audience. And that, doing that for 5 years thinking, how do I perform and entertain, really helped me. And then just having lots and lots of opportunities. Like when I worked in front of, in the summer camp business, you know, from June through August, you know, every day I was up in front of an audience that usually ranged in age from like 11 to, you know, most of them were 11 to 15. And then there was another group that was like 18 to 25. But you know, I really cut my teeth on trying to educate and inform and hold the attention of 13-year-olds. And so that was good practice for me. Those two things, I think, the camp experience and then also the marching band performing experience.
I was just thinking, for me, it's been the
kids
practice.
Kids are a great
too.
Audience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Real genuine and immediate mm-hmm. feedback. Like if you bomb, exactly. It's really obvious. And if you're working it and they like it, you know, like they're just on the edge of their seats and their bodies are tensed up and they're just like waiting for you to like give them the cue that they could laugh or yell or whatever. They just mm-hmm. want to like be really expressive.
I was like, Lisa, it was sort of,
yeah, they don't have a sense of false politeness,
right?
I'm sorry, Rob.
Oh, I was gonna say, like, it was sort of serendipity for me. I was working with an ambulance service in Whistler, British Columbia, a ski resort, and the unit chief there asked me if I would be the training officer. And I, you know, at first I said no. I don't think I have enough experience. I don't think you really want me to do that. And he said, well, the Blackcomb ski patrollers come to our training nights every Tuesday night, and you'll get free ski passes. So of course I said okay. So I sort of fell into that. But I was thinking, for me personally, it was just practice. And I was going to ask you, Lisa, what do you recommend to people who don't speak that often, but they really need to practice doing it to get good at it?
Yeah, I actually, I recently wrote a blog post about that too. And that was basically the one thing that you can do to become a better speaker is practice. Because a lot of people, even when they do have opportunities to speak, they don't practice enough before their presentation. They may throw it together, they may go over it in their head and never once say it out loud. So practicing is really important. Getting in front of a variety of audiences is really important. And for people who are, I have kind of two lists or two examples of how people can practice, because some people have a workplace and that's actually a great training ground for speaking, and some people don't, like me. I'm by myself at my computer all day. And so for somebody who has a workplace, I would suggest that you offer to facilitate team meetings, you know, take turns, share the responsibility for facilitating meetings. Always prepare something to share. I have a couple clients who are really afraid of speaking up at meetings. So I've given them homework and I've said, every meeting, every time you have your staff meeting, have something prepared. Either something that you want to share or a question you want to ask. find a way to get that experience, even in a meeting, just speaking up and asking a question. But plan it in advance so that you're not at the last minute kind of feeling caught off guard. You know, give the report for your team, ask to take the lead on a group project, start a joke of the month at your staff meeting, practice your joke telling skills, join the office book club, join a volunteer group. A lot of workplaces have a lunch and learn, kind of a brown bag lunch type of a thing where different employees can stand up and talk on whatever topics they want. And so these are all ways, you know, in your workplace, if you have a place where you go with other people, there are a lot of built-in opportunities for that. And then if you don't have a workplace, or maybe it's not appropriate for you to find ways to speak in your workplace, a lot of people will do readings at their church, their place of worship. They can practice speaking up in Bible study. They can help teach a class. Networking organizations are really great for practicing public speaking because most of them require that you give some sort of a 20 to 30 second commercial or little introduction about yourself at every meeting. And so you can really refine that and get good at that. Mm-hmm. The group I'm speaking at tomorrow has 3 speakers each month, and we do 10 minutes each, and whoever wants to speak can get on the calendar. And then I also will mention Toastmasters. Although I have some reservations about some of the practices of Toastmasters, I'm not going to say that I agree with everything that they do, but I will say that you will always get a supportive and encouraging audience there. And the people in Toastmasters really have good hearts, and they really want you to feel comfortable and in front of an audience, and they'll do their best to make you feel comfortable and confident. And so it's a great place to go and have a built-in audience if you don't have other places to speak. But I do think it's important to speak in the real world, in places where the audience may not be 100% supportive, or where there may be waiters clanking plates, or a loud air conditioning system, or somebody who runs in late and slams the door. I mean, I think it's important to get that kind of real world experience because Toastmasters can be a little bit insulated.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very long answer.
Right.
That's
great advice. And I know Greg wants to wrap up.
We really are at the point. Yeah. We got to wrap this up.
I was just going to quickly say that for me personally, I found that teaching CPR and first aid, which is a really quick course and something you do over and over and over again, really helped me to become a more confident speaker because it was the same message repeated again and again.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you on that one too. Lisa, if like, we'll put the blog link in the show notes, but other links or anything specific way if a listener wants to connect with you that you would like them to do that?
The easiest way to reach me would be through my website, and that's coachlisab.com.
Okay.
And then all of my other contact, my phone, email, blog, Twitter, Facebook, all my information is there.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for being part of the EMS Educast. We really appreciate it. I've enjoyed a lot of during this last hour, and I actually made some notes of things that you did as a speaker, particularly when you said, that's a good question. Let me collect my thoughts and write down a few things before I go, that I'm one to speak as I think, and that was a good reminder for me of that technique sometimes to pause and organize.
Your audience doesn't mind if you take a minute to gather your thoughts.
Right. So there's a couple times tonight where I was like, oh, that's...
Well, thanks, Greg.
That's something I got to remember. So thank you so much for being part of the show, and hopefully we could have you back sometime. And listeners, please connect with Lisa at CoachLisaB.com or the blog as well that you can get to from there, or the show notes. And remember, you can find the EMS Educast and lots of other great EMS and medical podcasts at the ProMed Network and our friends at the EMS Garage and EMS Leadership and the Pediatric University Podcast and First Few Moments Podcast and EMS Newbie and all those other ones are doing a lot of great shows. And so take some time and check out those shows, especially as we come up to our summer break in a few weeks. But Lisa, Rob, thanks so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.